chat system keeps blocking my freaking communication with you guys as spam. Whoever runs YouTube, you are a special kind of dumb. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. Today we're going to talk about everybody's least favorite subject, taxation. Except we're going to talk about it in, I bet, a way you've never heard a conversation about it before. What if I told you I'm going to give you the keys today to, no matter what your political belief system is, you can go have a conversation about taxation and its effects on society. I'm going to give you the tools you need to do this with somebody who is diametrically politically the opposite of you. If you are a conservative Republican that believes the marketing of the GOP versus its actions, you'll be able to go talk to a tax and spend liberal family member, and they see it starts already. There it is. Let me just read to you why we're doing this episode today. And why you need to take this and check it right into your back pocket if you're going to have a conversation like I'm promising you can. High Lux Radio says, I'm sorry, taxation is theft. I agree. And for the purpose of this discussion, you need to shut up. Now, normally I would say shut the F up, but I'm not going to today. So quick little disclaimer before we keep going today, okay? Usually I use words like the F word, the S word, the A word, combinations thereof. I'm going to do my damnedest to be a good little boy today and use no four-letter adult profane words, any of the stuff that would get you in trouble for saying it on broadcast television, so that this can be shared. And I hope that our friend here, High Lux Radio, can shut up for just a couple seconds with his mental block about this and let me continue. Let's see how it goes. So, as I was promising you, you'll be able to phone up, talk to, sit down, have a beer with the person who's diametrically opposed to you. If you are like me, an agorist, voluntarist, anarchist who thinks, like High Lux Radio, that all tax is theft, you will still be able to do it. But not if you say that, because that will make the average person go, shut up, go away, I don't want to talk to you. See, I actually want us to be able to discuss taxation. And I don't want to discuss it from a standpoint of, these people should pay more and these people should pay less. See, that's a fool's errand. That's the antlion trap. That's what they do to keep all of you yelling at each other and shouting at each other and screaming at each other and picking a side. I don't want to pick a side. Not even my own side today. I encourage you to take your ideology, shut up about it, put it in a nice little package and stick it in your back pocket where you keep your wallet. You care about your wallet. It's important because your ID, your credit cards, your money. So it's not like it's gone. You just need to put it on the shelf for about 90 minutes today. And then when you have the conversation that I'm going to give you the tools to have, you need to keep it there while you're having the conversation. We will never get people to critically analyze the system that we're in. And I promise you, if you listen today, you will have the tools to discuss this issue at a level that you've never even thought of having before. I don't care if you have a degree in economics. I don't care if you have a PhD in economics. You know what people hear from you when you have a PhD in economics and you try to explain it from your angle, no matter what it is? Wah, 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 wah. Like Charlie Brown's teacher. That's what they hear from you. If you are just well switched on, then they hear, I want my side. I don't want to do that. See, here's the thing that no one talks about with taxation. Taxation is not just a means to raise money for government programs. That is not the only thing that taxes do. Every form of tax has a social output equal to or greater than its monetary impact as far as revenue to the government and the programs can be paid for with it. In other words, every form of tax. We're going to go through the 12 macro forms of taxation today. So you'd be like, well, what about this or what about that? It will fall under one of these 12. I promise you, if you were a taxonomist, you know, this would be like the family, genus, species thing, that it will fall under one of the higher orders. Like a consumption tax is simply a form of sales tax. You understand that? Or an excise tax, It's one of the two. So we're going to go through these taxes and we're going to look at something. The incentives and the disincentives that each creates. So when you look at an income tax, a payroll tax, a sales tax, a value-added tax, it's not about whether it's good or bad, not from our point of discussion today. No, it is simply, when you do this, how do people in the society that you impose it on How do they react? What do they do? What do they do more of? And what do they do less of? See, like I said, this is one of those things, like, this is so polarized. This is so, tax the rich, eat the rich. Or corporations need lower tax rates so they can hire more people. Or whatever talking point you're on, it misses all this. I never discussed this when I took economics courses in school. I've listened to plenty of discussions by economists who are both, you'd say, more of the Keynesian mentality, modern monetary theory mentality. By the way, Keynes gets a totally bad rap, but we won't go in that today. Because Keynes based everything he said on a different monetary system than we ended up with when he was coming up with his monetary system. Flawed as it is, it's not as bad as it is in practice when you change the underlying system. But that's not what I want to talk about. Just what do people do? If you impose a tariff, what does it incentivize? What does it disincentivize? In fact, I have a really cool chart. And if you go to the show notes today, you can download a copy of it. And this chart shows you in a very simple thing, 12 primary macro taxes, and then the primary things that they incentivize and the primary things that they disincentivize. When you look at it that way, you can understand that taxation is a form of social engineering. Some of you may think that's bad. Some of you may think that's good. Some of you may think that can be good or it can be bad, right? It can be either way. I am sure, for instance, I'm going to hear from people today very angry with me. They say Jack is pro X tax, even though he's anti Y tax. Or Jack is pro this form of social engineering and then this, you know, anti this form. Or some other hateful thing will be sent to me in droves, because that's how these shows work. Whenever I'm completely objective, I'm accused of being both sides instead of being what I am objective. Look at the flag behind me. That's an agorist flag. This is the gray market. Below it is the black market. I am all about paying as little tax as possible. And if I had my way, if you made me king, I would eliminate every tax you can think of. But that's not the world we live in. See, I'm trying to come at this today as a pragmatist, as a realist, as somebody that actually can take a win when we get one and say this is a loss when it's a loss, even if my team did it. This is how you have conversations. And as soon as you tribalize in a conversation, especially something that hits everybody one way or another, then you can no longer have a conversation. What you have is a debate or an argument. What if you could have an exploratory conversation with your uncle, with your brother, with your father, with your cousin, with your best friend who diametrically opposes your political views? What if you could have a absolute 100% productive conversation even with somebody who is not in your lane? What if they came away from that conversation and they understood things at a higher level? They never shut down because you never gave them a reason to shut down. You actually never took a side. Can you do it? It's not easy, but if you do it, we can start a conversation that will get all of us further toward where we'd like to be, which is keeping more of our own money in our own pockets. No matter which stripe you come from with that, once you understand what these taxes are actually doing, and again, I'm not talking about, well, do we make a program to grow flowers for orphans? I'm not talking about that. Or a DEI program, or a program that's designed to incentivize small businesses. Those are all questions to do with, after the tax is collected, what do we do with the money? I don't even want to talk about that today. I don't want that to enter the conversation today. And when you have a conversation with your friend or your family member or whatever, I don't want it to enter there either, because you will never have a good conversation if you do. And when they take it there, go, that's great, we can talk about that next time. I don't want to talk about that today. All I want to talk about is what happens when we tax on each level. And I'm just interested in your opinion. See, people love to give their opinions. They actually don't want to listen to yours. But what you can use is leading questions that lead them to logical, concise, accurate answers. You could even take that printout right there that I'm going to make available to you today. And after you begin the conversation, not before, lay that down and say, you know what the source of this is? The source of this is ChatGPT. It's not Jack Spirko. I didn't make that list. I didn't decide what it incentivizes or disincentivizes. I asked ChatGPT to list the macro tax categories. It actually created some redundancy I finagled out. And I did say, hey, don't you think inflation's a tax? And it said, yeah, you're right. And it put it back in. And then it made me that chart. It also wrote me a whole bunch of shit here. that I'm going to share with you today. It wrote me the historical examples of all 12 taxes and what happened when they were first implemented and what the results were. And then, well, I'm going to tell you about the rest of it later, because we did a thought experiment at the end of our discussion, I and ChatGPT, about, well, something that I picked up as an idea from somebody in the TSP workshop group. With that, before we get into this conversation, let us go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Berkey Water Filter Systems. That's with Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason at usaberkeyfilters.com. Jeff Gleason has sponsored our show since 2010. It's 2025. That's 15 years in the world of podcasting. It's an eternity. There aren't even that many podcasts I would venture that are 15 years old, let alone have sponsors that have been loyal to him for that long. So you should be loyal to him. Water is important. It is literally life. Water is life. And when something's wrong with your water and they tell you to boil it, usually that something's been wrong for a while first, while you and your family have been drinking the water. So drink the best water you can on a daily basis and check out usaberkeyfilters.com to make that happen. Next today is John Pugliano with the Wealth Steading Podcast. I am going to tell you about some things today about how to actually not exit the system, but work the system. See, once you understand the taxation, the incentives and disincentives, then you can actually maximize that system the way rich people do. The rich people get richer. That's because they know how to work the system. That's because they literally teach their children a blueprint. And some of the things that I'm going to talk about, you can do on your own. Some of them you need professionals for. But some of the investing, you're going to want a guy like John for. And you want to know what he knows. So check out wealthsteading.com, where you can hear his podcast for free about once a week and learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. With that, let's go ahead and jump on into this. Again, what I want to come at today, and if you're going to share this, then you might want to share it really from this point forward. And if you use YouTube, you can just, you know, set the link so that it starts at like 11:50 or something and share it on YouTube, or use the site and tell them to jump to it, you know, 12 minutes in or whatever. And it won't bother me at all, because people that haven't become accustomed to listening to the show may not want to hear the whole intro and Jack going a little bit, well, Jack. So let's talk about this again today. Why do I want to do this? Again, I will give full disclosure here. If I don't give full disclosure and somebody hears this show, they're going to think that I was deceptive. So yes, that's an agorist flag. I am an anarchist. I am an agorist. I am an anarcho-libertarian in the pure form. I believe there is no absolute need for a state. And I would, if I had my way, put us on a path to eliminate the state altogether. And I would do it over time. I'm not a crazy person like some people in my world that thinks you can just throw a switch overnight and not have chaos when you've built society for, you know, eons on these types of systems. It would have to be a slow weaning away for that to work. But if I don't say that, number one, first of all, I got you special kids out there that will say that I've become a statist or something stupid. Or more importantly, the people that are willing to listen to this, that don't believe what I believe, won't listen to me because of what I believe. Or they'll find out later and think I've pulled one over on them. So I am giving you a disclaimer up front. I don't want to hear any more crap about it today, guys, or I am self-censoring today for everybody's benefit. I don't want to hear any crap about it. I'm coming at this completely objectively. My goal is, again, to make people be able to talk about taxes with other people who don't agree with them and have a productive conversation. I know that's crazy talk, but give me the chance today and I'll show you how. And one thing we can all agree on is that taxes affect behavior. Taxes affect behavior. Here's, you know, if you think about it, there was the guy that was choked to death. I think his name was Michael Brown. I could be wrong. I could be confusing him with somebody else. He was choked to death on the streets of New York City because he resisted arrest when he was being arrested for selling loose cigarettes. The only reason a person can walk around the streets of New York City and selling individual cigarettes for like a buck a piece or something isn't it because people are that addicted to cigarettes that they'll buy one cigarette at a time because I'm out. It's because the taxes on tobacco that are so high, especially in places like New York City, that I can go to a state like Virginia, buy cigarettes by the carton, go to New York City and make a profit. That's a behavior. It's an illegal one, but it's a behavior that is caused by taxation. Eric Garner is who Tom says it was, and I will agree that he's probably right. And I'm probably too many things in the back. But it's just a behavioral change. I'm not judging it. I know that it's hard for you to believe that somebody would do a podcast and not judge the behaviors they're discussing. I have a judgment, but I'm not giving it to you today. I'm not coming at this from that. I'm being impartial in this. And there are 12 taxes that almost every tax would fit under if we consider these the macro taxes. Again, if we were doing taxonomy, these are your high-level, you know, orders. They are, and I'm just going to give you the taxes first, then we're going to go through them. Income tax, payroll tax, sales tax, value-added taxes, property taxes, capital gains taxes, tariffs, excise taxes, estate and inheritance taxes, wealth taxes, and corporate taxes, along with inflation. Okay, those are the taxes that we're going to talk about today, and we're going to go through them individually, and we're not going to judge them or say they should be higher or lower, or they shouldn't be here at all. We're just going to simply say, well, what does each one of these taxes cause to happen? So let's start off with income tax. What does income tax incentivize? What does it cause people to work harder at? See, that's what incentivize means. People to steal or whatever. Stop inserting your bias. I know some of you are, so I'm going to do that a couple times here and there to kind of emotion check you. What does it just do? If I jack your income tax up to 50%, whether you're poor or rich, I don't care. If I jack your income tax up to 50%, what will you do? Just pay it? See, the people that will say, well, I guess I would just pay it, they're not ready for this conversation yet. They're either not aware there's something that can be done, or they're not open to being aware that something can be done. It's up to them, but it incentivizes tax avoidance strategies. When you have high personal income taxes, people who normally just fill out the form and send it in, fill out the long form. They go get a CPA. They ask their CPA, what do I do to cut my horrible tax bill? So when you put an income tax in place at various levels, as you go up, of course, a higher one has more of the incentive and more of the disincentive. So a low one will have only a little bit of that, and the higher you go, the more people will be incentivized to use tax avoidance strategies because no one likes giving their money up that they earned, especially. What does it disincentivize then? Productivity and high earnings. What's the point, especially if I'm not running a business where I can play all the other games? If I'm a W-2 employee, what's the point of absolutely killing myself to move way up the ladder for a better title and better income if in the end I'm only going to make a little bit more than if I just kind of went middle of the road, kept my job for as long as I need to I retire? It absolutely, when we tax income, we disincentivize production. And again, this is not tax bad. That's just the net result. I am going to structure my life to minimize my taxable income. Part of that is going to have an effect on people that can't do it at my level, because I'm pretty sophisticated in my tax strategy. They are simply going to be less motivated by especially small raises. Imagine if you got a 10% raise, you kept it all. That's a big difference of getting a 10% raise and having a net raise of, let's say, 4 to 5%, which many people will experience, especially at certain points where they cross over to different tax brackets if they were just under and then go just over. Now, if you move way up in a tax bracket, that's different. But do we move up that way? Do people in general, when they get raises, get huge raises or small raises? Now, if you get a brand new job or a brand new position in a company, you're promoted to like a, you know, a high level director or something. Sure, that can be a big raise. But most people are looking at 3% raises. So how hard are you going to work when a 3% raise is going to be eroded to 1.5%, especially if you cross a tax bracket in it? You're not going to work as hard. So you're going to try to pay less. You're going to try to reduce your taxable income. I didn't say reduce your income. I said reduce your taxable income, and you'll see how that plays out elsewhere here, meaning you will seek other forms of income that are taxed at a lower rate. If you tax my income at 20% and you tax capital gains at 20%, I don't really care about the difference except for payroll taxes that we're going to go through next. But if you tax my income at 40 and you tax my capital gains at 20, the first thing any thinking person is going to do is say what? How do I move my income from the earned income category to the capital gains category? any accountant, if you run a small business, is going to tell you, that's going to be one of the first things they're going to tell you. Set up an S corporation and pay yourself a dividend in addition to your salary. It's not hard to figure out that that's what's going to happen because this, again, it's not about whether you think it's good or bad. It's not whether I think it's good or bad. It's what will it do? What's the payroll tax incentivize? For most people, I think they're completely unaware of this. Most people, you're paying more in payroll tax than income tax, especially if you make, let's say, less than $50,000 a year. If you make 50, 60 grand a year, it's almost inevitable. You're paying way more in payroll tax than you are in income tax. You're paying very low income tax. By the time you take your standard deductions, even with a $50,000 income, you're paying almost no income tax at all. I know that's hard to believe, and the few thousand you pay feels like a lot of money because it's your money, but it's not really the big tax. What most people are unaware of, payroll tax, for those that don't snap to it, that's basically your Social Security taxes. And whatever you pay, your employer pays too. Now, I know you're like, well, I don't get it. Well, actually, sort of, kind of, after the government does its thing, when you retire, you do. Okay? I'm not going to say it's a fair exchange. I'm just going to say that you do get it back. But your employer doesn't care what basket your expense to them goes in. I've employed people. I've employed at one time almost 3,000 people in one company. It wasn't the only company I was running at the time. Okay, we had 2,500 contractors on average, sometimes more, and 50 in-house. And we had to make a payroll for that every week. I don't care why Bill cost me $150,000 a year. I don't care what his paycheck is. I care what his expense is. So when you make me add an expense to Bill's payroll, the amount of money I can put into his salary goes down. So what is a payroll tax incentivize? Automation and under-the-table work. That's what it incentivizes. I've talked about this. When I was a teenager, one of my first real jobs was under the table. And I worked for a dude named Muskrat Purcell. I mean, you can't make that up. That's about as redneck Appalachia as it gets. And my job was I pulled parts off of cars in his junkyard. It was a really great job for a teenager. I was still riding a bike. That's how young I was, right? I'd ride my bike up to this dude's place. He's never even there. I would work on like Saturday and Sunday were the days I worked. He was closed on Saturday and Sunday. So it was a good day for me to pull all the parts orders that came in. There'd be a list of where the cars are, what to pull. I'd take the tools that I kept there and I'd go pull the parts. I'd put them in bins where and note where they were. And in the desk drawer, there was cash money from last week. And I was paid by the part I pulled. And I was working under the table. I put the cash in my pocket. In my head, under the table was good because I wasn't paying income tax. Now, as a 15-year-old kid making about $5,000 a year, how much income tax was I actually going to pay? Check shit. What benefited him wasn't me not paying the tax. It was him not having to match my SSI. That's why he would want to employ someone under the table in the first place. Your employer doesn't give a shit about the taxes you pay. It doesn't affect them. If you pay $5,000 in taxes or $10,000 or $50,000, it doesn't affect the company's bottom line at all. They only care about what you cost. So when you jack up payroll, then you say, hey, employers, the less headcount you have, the less overhead you're going to have on this additional expense that we've applied. Okay? So that incentivizes automation, especially today. But it also incentivizes paying people cash money under the table. That's the only thing your company paying you under the table gains by paying you under the table. In many ways, they're much better off paying you above the table. Why? Because now I can't deduct your expense. I'm not talking about making somebody a contractor, though it incentivizes that too, which then causes government to make it harder to be a contractor. Because they don't want that loophole. They're not worried about you not getting yourself. They're worried about them not getting their money into their payment system, which is what Social Security is. When you pay Social Security taxes and your employer matches it, that money does not go in a box that says this is for builder of castles who's listening to us right now. It doesn't. It doesn't go there. It goes to pay people right now. Your Social Security, you get a ledger entry that you made a payment and you're entitled to a payment in the future, but your money will not come from your stash. It doesn't go on a lockbox. No, some kid that's right now crapping his pants will be working to pay your Social Security when you retire. This is not my opinion. This is not a judgment. This is how it works. The Social Security payments today are made from the Social Security taken in today, not the Social Security taken in 40 years ago. I didn't say to cut Social Security. I didn't say it was bad. Don't put words in my mouth, please. It's just what happens. So what does it disincentivize? Hiring and wages. The more I pay you, the higher the percentage I have to match. And now we've moved that number up like 175 a year. The cap on payments into Social Security used to be like 95,000 a year, meaning once you got over that number, you stopped paying in. They keep jacking that cap up. So the more I pay you, the more that line item expense goes up, even though it's not directly correlated to your salary, it's a percentage thereof. And again, as an employer, this is very important to understand. Very important to understand. You are not an expense based on your salary. You're an expense based on your total cost. Your total cost includes the desk you sit at, the electricity that you're a share of, and certainly your workers' comp, your payroll tax, all of that, the matching. Now, let's move on to sales tax. Sales tax is something that most people don't really notice. Most people ignore sales tax. It's just, it is what it is, right? Part of that is we've been conditioned that that's just the way that it is. But the other part of it is in most places, it's not that much. It'd be at least sub 10%, and it's only on money you spend. And in a lot of places, it's 4, 5, 6%. So if you go out and you buy $3 worth of shit, it's, you know, 6%, it's 18 cents. And we just don't even, we don't think about how it adds up. And trust me, before they changed the way that taxes are done with assault deductions under Trump's first term, we kept every receipt we had, and we put all of our sales tax into a line item on our tax return. And when you do that, you realize how much that it adds up. It just really doesn't make sense for us to do that right now. And we'll see what happens when this current, the current tax policy in place expires this year, if it's not renewed or replaced. So it'll go back to the way that it was then. And then you'll maybe start to realize, if you itemize your taxes, how much you pay in sales tax. But what does sales tax incentivize? What does it create more of? When I apply a sales tax, especially, you'll see, if you put a 3% sales tax on stuff, you won't really notice it, but it'll happen. And as you keep increasing it, you'll get more of what happens. Very simple. And that is saving and bartering. That's what sales tax incentivizes. If I know that when I spend money, it's going to cost more, I'm less likely to spend it, and therefore it actually curtails spending. It reduces spending. And it also increases barter. What's the sales tax when you bring me your empties and I reload ammunition for you? And when I give it back to you, you hand me a bag of beef jerky. What's the sales tax? There's nothing. There is nothing that happens when that happens, right? I mean, if you tell the government, technically you're supposed to do taxes on it, but it's not what, nobody does that. I bet you anybody listen to me, you've made some swap or trade. I'll come do this for you. You do that for me. According to the government, you're supposed to both report it as income. Let me kind of be clear on this. Let's say you're a painter and you say, no, I'll paint this room $300. And the person you're doing it for is someone who cuts hair for a living, your hairdresser. And they say, well, what I'll do is I'll give your family six haircuts at $50 a haircut in return for you painting the wall. You're supposed to both report that as $300 of income, but nobody does it. And if you reported it as a sale, it should also carry a sales tax, but nobody reports it, so it doesn't. And even if you reported it, no one's going to go out of their way and set up an account with their state comptroller to do sales tax on 4 or 5 barters a year. But the higher, the more things cost in the open market, the more people rely on the gray market. That's just, again, this is not a judgment. It's just what happens. So what do sales taxes disincentivize? What do they create a negative impact on? Spending, consumer spending. The more there is a tax on a sale, the more expensive a thing is. Again, because most sales taxes are relatively small, and they go largely unnoticed, they've been factored in as a cost that most people don't think about them. It doesn't mean it doesn't affect your spending. I'll put it a different way. When you spend on something subject to sales tax, there's two buckets of money. Bucket A goes to the merchant. That's, you know, Walmart. Walmart takes your money. And you paid Walmart $137. And you think, well, Walmart got $137. Technically, they did. But let's say 15 of it isn't theirs. It has to go to the state. Or 10 of it has to go to the state. And that adds up to billions of dollars to all the states every year, just in America, let alone other countries. All the other countries do similar forms of taxation. And that means that that money is not in the economy to be spent by consumers anymore. It is in the hands of government to pay for government programs. That's how tax works. Again, I'm not judging it. All I'm saying is if you take billions of dollars of spending out of your state on products and services, you have less sales of products and services. That's simple math. It's just what happens. How about a value-added tax or a VAT tax? Fortunately, this is something that our government in the United States hasn't done yet. That is my opinion. That's me going off of what I promised today. But we pay all these other taxes. I think that, you know, 11 of the 12 is enough. But a VAT tax is like a sales tax on steroids. A VAT, like most distribution systems, are multi-level. Meaning that when you go to, let's say you're going to buy, this has a different tax on it, but we'll just do it anyway. You're going to go buy a six-pack of beer. And you're going to buy that beer at your local 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven didn't buy the beer, right, from Budweiser or from Michelob or what have you, right? 7-Eleven bought it from a distributor who bought it from a wholesaler who bought it from the brewery. Additionally, in this country anyway, let's say, you know, Yingling Brewery buys a bunch of grain. Since it's not the final point of sale, they don't pay a tax on the grain or the yeast or the water. They pay tax on their electricity, their payroll taxes, their income taxes. They don't pay a sales tax. Sales tax is generally charged at the final point of sale. So a product may have gone through 10 levels of distribution because it was a raw material that went to a refiner of some sort, like a grinder, right? Somebody who grinds or gristmills the grain that goes to the brewery and then it goes to all these other levels before Bill pulls his truck over on the way home from his construction job, buys that pack of beer. A VAT tax takes a piece at every level of distribution. So the farmer sells the grain to a distribution house for grain, and that is a tax. And then that distribution house sells a portion of the grain to somebody that mills it for breweries, and it's taxed. And then that distributor sends it over to the brewery, and it's taxed. The brewery then puts it in the beer, and the beer is taxed as a whole. That's a piece of the cost. And it's all the way through. So what does that incentivize? And by the way, European countries love this shit. This is their favorite form of tax because they get to ping it at all these levels. Well, a value-added tax incentivizes black market trade. It drives the cost of goods up to such a level that you're economically, in a lot of situations, going to go back door to make your buy because you can't afford it anymore. There is a point where if this is a thing that I really want or I really need and I don't have the money for it, but there's another way to get it, I'll take that. The other thing is, what does it disincentivize? Well, business expansion. Like, how am I going to grow my business in this model? And what it actually incentivizes is a collapse of the system down to a flatter distribution market, getting closer to selling direct to the customer. That's how, if I was in a country that did this and I was running a brewery, then I would want to buy my grain, if possible, direct from a farmer. If I can't buy it direct from a farmer, then I'm going to have that one level VAT tax. I'm going to do my own milling or whatever. Like, I'm going to do everything I can in-house before I let it out. That way, I'm not subject to these intermediate taxes on my final product. So that's the other thing it's going to do, is make a flatter distribution system, which is going to reduce jobs Because to do that, most companies are going to employ automation, and at least it's going to reduce the number of people doing the paperwork, the number of Karens in HR, et cetera, will all go down under a VAT tax, unless the government forces them back in so that it can engineer its grift, which is, again, my opinion. But one way or another, what you really get out of a VAT tax, more black market trade, flatter distribution systems, and less investment in growing a business and expanding a business, because it hurts everywhere that you do it. Some of these countries even tax intercompany costs. So within a company, a lot of times you'll have silos and there'll be intercompany billing, because that's how you keep the different departments of a company honest. There are some places where VAT taxes even apply to that, as crazy as that sounds. How about property tax? They were all familiar with what property tax is. Property tax is you finally saved up and you bought a house, and then you get a bill, and the bill says your mortgage payment is $1,600. And you look at your mortgage, and like $35 came off your mortgage balance. You go, wait a minute, wait a minute. I understand amortization over 30 years, but what's going on here? And you look, and there's line items, and you find out what you're actually paying on your mortgage is like $600. And then you got insurance, taxes, and some other expenses like PMI insurance built in there. But the biggest one is going to be a bunch of different kinds of property tax. The county wants their share. The city wants their share. Some places there's a hospital tax. There's a school tax. And there's a general services tax. There's all different flavors of this. And this can be on a relatively modest home in some places like New Jersey or New York, $20,000 a year. $20,000 a year is insane to me, given that my first full-time job, I made about $16,000 a year. I know I'm old, but I ain't that old. And so I can understand why a young person says, I'll never be able to afford a house. Hell, they can't afford the property tax, let alone the mortgage and all the other costs, electricity and everything else. So what do we incentivize when we tax property? Well, somebody always has capital. Somebody always has access to capital. And in the property business, those people become landlords. Again, I'm not judging it. I don't feel rent seeking or they're valuable. Like, I don't care about, I'm not in the polarized world today, guys. I know it's hard to believe, but I'm not. All I'm saying is when you tax property, you incentivize renting. You incentivize a person to stay a renter instead of making the sacrifices to invest in a property that they own and stay in a long time. You know, your grandparents or some of you younger guys, your great grandparents. I'm talking about people that maybe bought their first home before the Great Depression, during the Great Depression, or right after World War II. People in that block of time. There was hardly any property tax. Do you know what your grandma and your grandpa did, or your great grandma and your grandpa did when they bought a house? They said, we ain't putting no money in this place unless we have to until it's paid for. That was their number one goal. Pay it off. 5 to 7 years on average for people at a time when they had a lot less money, because it wasn't an additionally burdened cost on the housing, which meant the minute that they paid the house off, they had no real cost of maintaining the home. Now they developed the property. They added on a room and no one penalized them for adding on a room. They put in a pond. No one said, hey, your property's worth more. You owe us more money now. Again, I'm not judging. I'm just telling you that's what happened prior to, and you know what happens today. So what do we disincentivize with property taxes? We disincentivize home ownership and land improvement. There is, if you improve your property, you pay a higher tax on it. That's why a lot of us that are in the world that I'm in, we like to do improvements that the government doesn't understand. We like to go plant 1,000 trees on a property, many of them productive in a variety of ways, because a tax assessor doesn't really understand that. But you add a room on, the value of your property in some locations, after you beg for permission to do it, right, can go up $50,000 because you added a bedroom onto your house. Well, hello, your taxes just went up $300, $400, $500 a year, and that will magnify each year as it continues to go up forever as long as you own the house. So that's what property taxes do. Now, again, I know some of you are saying Jack's being really negative about taxation, and he said he wouldn't be. I'm actually not. I'm just telling you what happens. I'm also going to put it to you this way. If you actually want a system that doesn't completely disincentivize all the positive things and doesn't, you know, incentivize all the negative things, then the taxes themselves are a direct reflection of the impact, meaning the higher the tax, the higher the impact. So if a property tax incentivizes renting and tax loopholes and disincentivizes home insurance and land improvement, the higher it goes, the more that's true, and the lower it goes, the less that impact. And in the end, most of you believe the government needs at least X to do Y and Z, roads and schools, whatever it is for you. Okay, fine. Then you're going to have to raise the same amount of revenue, right? So the purpose of this discussion is, well, then how do you do it? What things are you most willing to sacrifice? And which places are you most willing to sacrifice revenue to incentivize the positive behavior that comes with it? And how does this all interact in the end? Because no place only does one of these taxes, do they? Most of them do one way or another, whether it's federal or state or local, they do at least 11 of the 12 today. At least 11 of the 12. The only one that I'm going to tell you doesn't really affect you in America is the VAT tax, yet anyway. Okay, so let's move on. Capital gains taxes. A capital gains tax is pretty straightforward in the way that it works. You invest in something, whether it's a business you founded, a stock you purchased, you know, whatever it is, you've invested in something. And when you sell it or receive a dividend from it, it's not earned income. It wasn't directly correlated to your work. It didn't come out of your W-2 paycheck. And even a lot of business owners, like myself, we run a payroll on ourselves. There's a lot of things in your life it makes easier if you do, by the way. Like when you're trying to get credit to buy a house, having a W-2 job, even though you're your own employer. Can I call your employer? Sure, I'm here, right? It's still beneficial, but there's a tax benefit as well. And that tax benefit is some of that income can now become a capital gain paid as a dividend. And then it's going to still be taxed pretty hard because it's short term in that formation, but it doesn't go into that payroll tax. And there's a lot of other things we can do with capital gains to mitigate them. In other words, a short term capital gain. I bought this stock. It went up 8%. I immediately dumped it and harvested my profit. I pay a high capital gain. I bought this stock 5 years ago. I want to change my investment today. I will pay a lower tax on that capital gain, not just because payroll taxes aren't part of it. That's how it works. It's not a judgment. That's how it works. Yeah? One more time. That's how it works. This is not some crazy guy making his case to you. That's how it works. So it incentivizes holding assets longer. That's what it incentivizes. If you have capital gains tax at all, then my incentive is to hold my asset longer. And here's why. Let's say that my asset has made me a 20% profit, but I'm going to pay 20% of the profit, 20% of the 20% back in taxes. Well, you know, I'm kind of feeling like I want to change my investment strategy here, or I want to start a new business and I could liquidate this ownership stake. Maybe I only own like 10% of a company. I could sell it to my partners and take that money and go do something else with it. But when I start looking at how much it's going to get eaten away in capital gains taxes, I may say, I think this is going to be worth more in a year, and I'll actually get net what my gross would be today. So I'll hold on longer. So what it's going to do then is it's going to make me less likely to invest in other projects, to take my proceeds and go and invest in something else. Again, this is not my opinion. And I'm going to go through when I get done with these and give you historical examples of each and every one of them. Then, but the other side, what does it disincentivize? Investment in liquidity. Right, I'm not going to be as apt to take capital from one place and invest it in another, including doing things like I'm not going to liquidate this business I built. But what I'm going to do is take a pretty good hit on capital gains in order to extract from it and invest in another business. So that business never gets formed. It never gets created. Or this business over here that's languishing a little bit but could benefit. It could benefit from an infusion of capital. It's just right on the edge of being good. Well, I'm likely to go seek a loan for it rather than harvest a capital gain from another business unit. Because if I lose, I still have my money over here, and I didn't pay any tax on it, and I still have it all. And this business folds, well, it folds. Okay, the creditor is the one really taking the bath, not me. My corporation went bankrupt, not me. Now, you might not like that, but I'm back to this is how things work. This is the way things are. So that's what happens when we tax capital gains. And the higher we tax a capital gain, the more of those two sides happen. Again, you don't have to like it. It's just true. How about tariffs? That's the orange man word, isn't it? I mean, I think people are probably way more emotional over this word right now than they were 10 years ago. There's no reason to be more emotional over it. They've existed forever. They were the primary way that the government raised revenue for about 70 years in this country in the 1800s. That's what they were. Again, this is not my opinion. Yeah? Okay? What do they incentivize? Domestic production. What's a tariff? Will the people pay the tariff? I know. It's a type of sales tax. It's a selective type of sales tax. It's a sales tax that only applies to goods made outside the jurisdiction that's imposing the tariff. Meaning when you buy a product from Germany or Italy or Japan or Canada or Mexico or Brazil, it will have an added tax on it, but it won't be a line item. You know, you want to know how expensive sales tax is? Go buy a car. Go buy a car and finance it. And a cheap car today, what, 35, 40 grand? And then you come in with this big old down payment, and you think, well, I just bought it down like with $5,000 cash. I brought my note down from $40,000 to $35,000. That's going to help my payment. Well, it helped your payment, but not the way you thought, right? There'll be a line item in there. In Texas, it's probably 8.25% on a $40,000 purchase. Your down payment, tax title license is almost gone right out of the gate. You haven't actually brought down what you owe on the vehicle itself hardly at all, even with a big down payment. That's how that works, right? But you see the number. Sales tax. When you buy the car and the car was made in Japan or Korea or China or wherever, and there's a tariff on it, all you see is the sticker price. You don't see the tariff in there. But if it's a Japanese car, it's 25%. I believe it's either 15 or 25. It's known as the chicken tax. It's been around since the 60s. Right. It's in there. You just don't see it. But what does it then incentivize? I'm sorry, what does it then disincentivize? International trade. And I think some people are like, that's great. Okay, is it? I think it's back to what is the net impact of the tariff? If you're importing from a country, and that country has a very low cost of production, and you throw a tariff of 15% on it, and it's still a very competitive product in your host nation market, let's say America, since that's what most of my listeners are from, then people still keep buying it. And then the government actually earns a lot of income off of it, and people don't necessarily make the choice to buy American or buy, you know, if it's Germany, buy German, or Japan, buy Japan, right? Or Canada, buy Canada. It's just a slogan then. It's not really a financial incentive. But if you push it high enough that you actually curtail the amount of sales from the imported product, then the net effect is people spend that money on a domestically made product. And this either benefits you or doesn't benefit you based on getting the balance just right. Because if you push it too far in either direction, well, I just think tariffs are bad. We shouldn't have tariffs at all. And then you wonder why you have a $300 billion trade deficit with a particular block of countries. Because they're tariffing the shit out of you. So you're not doing anything in reprisal. So therefore, they're going to maintain a net inflow and you're going to maintain a net outflow, right? By not tariffing. You're going to decimate your domestic economy as long as, it's back to the thing is, do you need this weapon? Well, does your enemy have it? Does your adversary have it? Are they using it against you? I mean, I'll go to Jack's personal view here for just a second. My tariff policy, if I was emperor of the United States, would be I will tariff you at 2 times whatever you tariff me at for the most expensive thing you tariff me on. If you have a specific tariff on my wheat of 25%, I tariff every single thing that you import in my country at 50%. Oh, my God. He just went crazy. I was with this guy. Hold on. What's 2 times 0? See, my goal would be no tariffs in either direction. Let us all do what we're best at. That's my opinion. But that's not how it works. Even Orange Man hasn't gone that kind of like medieval on this thing with the option to have zero, right? So you have to be like, that's the only way you could win in the society we're in. I'm back to my opinion here. But in the end, tariffs disincentivize your domestic production. Or I'm sorry, they incentivize your domestic production. They disincentivize international trade. That's what they do. That's how you have to look at it. You and I can disagree on what that means we should do, but we can't disagree on what it does. Because what it does is a fact, and what we extract from the fact, now we're in the world of opinion. How about an excise tax? I think first we need to know what an excise tax is. What is an excise tax? What is an excise tax? Does anybody know what an excise tax is? It's really kind of a sales tax. It differs from sales tax, though, in one way, like a tariff, that you don't see it. You don't see the line item for tax in an excise tax. You know what the most taxed things in the country, United States, is? Tobacco, alcohol, firearms. The top five items. I had them on a list from GPT, what they are, but they're all in that category one way or another. It's like spirits are taxed at one level, beer and wine taxed at another level. Then you got guns and ammunition, and then you got tobacco as your number one tax. This is why a lot of times excise taxes are referred to as sin taxes, right? And I'm going to put that graph up on the screen for you guys so you can follow me a little bit better, right? So what does an excise tax incentivize? Well, substitutes and black markets. One of the books I really recommend people read is a book called Ersatz in the Confederacy. And it's about, and this was a different reason for it, but it was shortages. And an ersatz is a cheap alternative. So an ersatz in the South for coffee, which was incredibly expensive and hard to get if you were in the South, would have been something like roasted chicory root and roasted okra seeds ground up to make coffee. Is it good? Not really. Does it work? It's something brown and warm, and you put a little milk in it, and it kind of sort of tastes like coffee. If you can come up with some sugar from your date tree, that's a substitute. That's an ersatz. What's the other thing that it would do, though, during that same period of time? There was blockades for shipping into the South, but there were people that ran those blockades. We call those smugglers. During the Revolutionary War period and prior leading up to it, there were smugglers that were smuggling brandy and wine and things into the colonies. That's your black market. And it's done at an industrial level, not just two guys selling pot to each other, right? Then it disincentivizes targeted goods consumptions. In other words, people buy less of the thing that you're taxing. Again, this is often referred to as sin taxes in our society today. Right? Sin taxes. And, you know, that's because of the alcohol, the tobacco. Screw them. If they want a booze, let them pay for it. And you don't even think about the impact that it has on things like bars, clubs, restaurants, etc., and all the people that work there that maybe don't even partake in the actual activity. So, but that's what it causes. And that's why right now you can see it in real life. If you were to right now, I don't know if it's every state, but certainly in my state, Texas, if you go to a convenience store, especially a non-chain store, not a 7-Eleven or a Quick Trip, something that's run probably by immigrants, probably from the Middle East, but not necessarily, you'll see a whole bunch of shit in there that's not what you think of as convenience store items. And there's one 2 miles from me. And you know what you'll see in there? Great big pouches of tobacco. And right underneath them, cigarette tubes with filters. And why does that exist? Because you can buy a little machine, if you're a smoker and I'm not, and you can go buy the tobacco and you can go buy the tube and do this. It's like, it's almost like reloading ammunition, pushing this little bit of tobacco in each tube. It takes not very long at all to do. And you can cut your cost on cigarettes by like down to 1/3 of the cost. Who would do that without that tax? You're going to get some form of substitution, black market, when you take this approach. And then you're going to have less consumption of the product itself hitting that piece of the economy. Where would you raise the money from if you had to raise the money for the things that you want based on this push-pull of all these different forms of taxes? How about estate and inheritance taxes? That's when your rich uncle dies. He leaves you $50 million, and you have to pay tax on the money he already paid tax on his whole life. Now, this one's been really mitigated in the United States. Very few people are subject to this tax anymore. People, you should get a trust because then you will never pay this. There's reasons to get a trust. It's a tax planning strategy. You should talk to your accountant. But unless you have enough money to blow the deduction per heir, don't worry about it. I'll tell you who this hits hard that are more middle-class people, farmers. They inherit the farm, and the tax assessor says the farm's worth $30 million. The damn thing has, you know, a net profit that comes off at a $200,000 a year if he's a family. There's no way they can afford the tax bill, and they end up having to liquidate the property. That person needs that land in a trust to shelter away from that. But that is a direct consequence of this type of taxation. That's what it is. A lot of people don't care about this because it doesn't apply to them, or at least they don't believe that it will ever apply to them. No one's going to leave me $20 million. And if they do, I'm going to pay tax on like $5 million of it. So that's okay, right? But it is a thing, and it does have a big impact on a lot of what we think of as middle America, those family farms and other land-based things. But again, there's a very easy way out of it, and that is through a trust relationship. So what does that then disincentivize? Wealth accumulation. Wealth accumulation. Do you want to know a loophole for this that rich people use all the time? They take a significant portion of their capital that's liquid and they put it into a whole life policy. Now, don't let somebody sell you whole life as that strategy when you make $25,000 a year, because if you make $100,000 a year, that doesn't work for you. But if you are super rich, it's one of the buckets you can put money into for your heirs that will come out of the total that's taxed. So you can just reduce how much Bill, your son Bill's going to get by putting a portion of Bill's money into a whole life policy and let it be paid out as life insurance. So one is life insurance, which is non-taxable, and one is an estate inheritance that is only taxable above a certain number. So it incentivizes creative tax structuring like that. What about wealth taxes? This is one we don't really have in the United States yet. There's a lot of people pushing for it. We're going to tax the wealthy. Okay. What happens if we do it? A wealth tax is you're worth $1 million, so you owe us $50,000 this year or $5,000 this year. Or you're worth $100 million, so you owe $1 million. It's basically a property tax on your money is the way to think about it. So you own your house. They say your house worth $500,000. You owe us $4,000 a year in property taxes. You're holding $500,000 in capital over here, liquid capital, or ownership in a company or a corporation. We're going to tax a percentage of that every year because the rich should pay their fair share. That's how it's marketed. What does that actually cause? Asset relocation and tax havens. That's what it causes. This is something you have got to understand. The more money you have, the more important this will be to you, and the more you will react to it. So the people that always get called out as needing to pay more taxes and justify all these things are the wealthy. But the wealthy are the ones with the means and ability to move the money in such a way that it doesn't apply to them. Wait till you hear my bonus for you from ChatGPT today. And again, thank you to the person in the workshop group that put this idea in my head. I didn't use your prompt, but I came up with one. I had kind of just seen it as I was doing a drive-by on the group. I'm like, oh, I'm going to put that in the back of my brain and use that next week. But that's what wealth tax does. It just, and you have to look at another impact of wealth tax. So you take a corporation. I don't want to give it a name here because somebody will hate or love the person that owns the corporation and is known for it. So we're just going to call it XYZ Corporation. And Bill Liptock, who I went to high school with, he went to the Marine Corps, I went to the Army, right? Bill Liptock owns XYZ Corporation, right? And it's worth $100 million. At least his shares in the company are $100 million in value in shares. Let's say he owns 52% of the company. And so we're going to tax him on that money. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have money. He has shares in XYZ Corporation. How does he convert those shares into money to pay the tax bill? There's only one way. He has to sell that much stock, plus he's going to have to sell a little more because on the next tax year, he's going to have a gain on his own stock that he sold, and you're illiquidating him, and you're reducing his ownership stake in his own company. What does that mean? That means when he opens his company up to partnership, he's going to be stingier. He's not going to be happy to say, you know what? I'm not talking about a publicly traded company either in this example, right? You know what? I'm totally okay owning 51% or 52% of my company. I just don't want to lose control of it. I don't care if I partner out 48% of the company, because when it comes right down to it and we have voting shares and we all vote, I will maintain ownership of the company. And that means if I completely disagree with my board of directors, I still maintain control of the company I built. It's a very understandable thing. Sometimes that guy's wrong, but in a free market, he has the right to be wrong and fail. It's his company. He built it. If he's going to make the wrong decision, it's going to hurt. Great. Then he'll learn from that, and he'll either restructure and revamp or he'll get called out and have to sell out. Okay? That's how that works right now. If you tax his wealth, he has to start devaluing his position every time you tax him because he doesn't just have the money sitting there to pay tax with. And while the wealthy do use debt for cash flow, they're not going to use it to pay taxes. That's a losing game, and they're not going to play the losing game. That's why they're wealthy in the first place. They don't play the loser's game. Now, you think I'm propping the wealthy up. I'm just telling you, people that have money, they got it somehow. They weren't all trust fund babies. And most of those trust fund babies were hearing talk like I'm giving you today when they were eight fucking years. Oh, sorry, there was one cuss word. Sorry, it's going to happen. When they were 8 years old, they were being exposed to these ideas when they were 8 years old. They're not going to play the losing game. Even if they had the money handed to them initially, they're going to usually be trained. Now, new money often just gives money to heirs and they piss it away and they end up in prison or they end up in, you know, rehab centers or whatever with no real consequence. We're not talking about that. Talking about people that actually build their wealth, they train their children. We're going to talk about that more today too. And then we have corporate taxes. Now, what do corporate taxes incentivize? Well, corporate taxes will incentivize offshore incorporation. They all offshore accounts. Why? Why would I do that? Do you think it's actually easier to be an American running a company that's based in China than it is to be an American running an American company based in America? Do you think it's easier? It's not. Why do I do it? Well, I don't personally run an offshore company, but if I did, why would I do it? Money. It's the only incentive that will make you do that. If this country over here gives me a corporate tax rate of 9% and America gives me a corporate tax rate of 22%, that's enough spread that it's probably worth the headache and the troubles and the regulations and everything else to move that corporate incorporation offshore of my country because there's enough money there to do it. If that country says our, you know, corporate tax rate is 12% and America's is 14. Trust me, I'm not doing it for 2%. I am not even considering it. It is way more trouble than you think, and it results in all types of problems. In other words, I can end up with a big company with billions of dollars stranded in China, like Apple had. They don't want it there, but the repatriation cost of that money is way too high for their shareholders to be okay with it. The American shareholder, your grandmother, that's in her retirement on a fixed income that has Apple in her ETFs, in her retirement account. Doesn't want it. Because it will reduce Apple's dividend and then reduce her income. This, again, I don't care if you like it or don't like it. That's what the corporate tax rate does. When you have very close corporate tax rates throughout the world, you have a very stable, I'm going to run my country, my company in this country mindset. When you don't have that, when you have large disparities, you have a lot more propensity, and that's the game these countries are playing with each other. You get a country like Georgia, not the state, the country that was formerly part of the Soviet Union, saying, you can come build a corporation here, pay 10%. What do you think they do that for? Do you think they just, they're just more business friendly, or are you thinking, they're like, you know, we don't really have the resources that the United States does. We just don't. We don't have the workforce. We don't have the education. We don't have the talent. They're going to have to import people to at least train the people that are going to do the work. They're going to have to deal with the tax consequences of being onshore and offshore. They're going to have to deal with a lot of things they wouldn't have to deal with. We need to be at least twice as cheap because that's the only way we're ever going to get any of that business. That's the push-pull. And what does it then disincentivize? Business growth and jobs, specifically domestically. If my corporate tax rate is cheap or non-existent, then I want to grow my company as big as I can right where I am. Why wouldn't I want to? It's where I can see it. I don't have to get on my jet and fly over an ocean to go look at it. I can walk my line every day if it's right here. Right? For all the talk you hear, these financial gurus on like TikTok and Instagram and all, you know, incorporate your company in Nevada or whatever because you won't pay. You're going to pay tax. Most people, small business, you're not going to be in a form of tax where you're actually going to save any money doing that. And now you've got just a whole mess to deal with. You got a registered agent sitting out in Nevada. You're in Florida. If you get sued in Nevada, you have to go because you headquartered your company there. No one really wants to do this unless they're big enough to make it worth doing. And corporate tax works largely the same way. Next up today is the inflation tax. This is the one that AI missed when it gave me my first list. It did not include inflation. And I spoke to AI about this, and we agreed that it is a hidden tax. And inflation is a property tax on your money is another way to think about it. Meaning your grandma, if she had managed to save up $10,000 in the 1920s, that was a lot of money. That was wealth. It was worth more than $100,000 is today. It's more than a 10x loss between 1925 and 2025. I'm 100 years, it's more than a 10x loss. But if she took that $10,000 and held it for 10 years, in 1935, it bought almost as much or even maybe more because of the depression and some deflation that went on. Like, her money held value. Nobody took anything from it. Not because they didn't want to, because there wasn't a mechanism in place the way there is today with inflation. The Federal Reserve, who controls the inflation rate through monetary creation and contraction, has a stated goal of 2 to 4% inflation per year. They usually fail to meet it, and 4% being repeatable is generous, which means if you have $100,000 in capital, and I don't care if you buy a really nice safe, have somebody cut a hole in the concrete of your floor, put it in stacks of hundreds, stick it in your floor, a year from now, you go turn the tumblers and you open it up and you pull the money out and you count it. There's still $100,000 in there. But effectively, if you had 4% inflation, it's $96,000 in purchase value. They took $4,000 of your wealth that year under that 4% inflation, and they did it primarily by expanding the monetary supply. Now, that's one of those, you know, big words for some people. They're not real familiar with expanding the monetary supply, what that means. What that means is when they print more dollars, the new dollars have to get value from somewhere. And they get that. They don't like go out and mine a bunch more gold, stick it in Fort Knox. That's old school, right? They don't do that anymore. You know, right now they're going to audit the Federal Reserve. They say Elon's going to go in and do it or whatever. It doesn't even mean anything. Let's say that all the billions of dollars in gold that they say are there. Every ounce is accounted for. It wouldn't cover 6 months of interest payments on the debt. at current gold values. It's been so long that we've been not pegged to gold that it's not even connected to each other anymore. That's what inflation has done. And now you're losing. So what do you lose? What do we incentivize and disincentivize when we do this? Well, we incentivize debt accumulation and asset hoarding. In other words, I would rather hold on to a house if I'm going to have so much inflation it's going to get eaten away, especially if I can rent that house to somebody else so I don't have the underlying cost on the asset and I just have cash flow off of it. That's way better than holding money, okay? And it will incentivize debt accumulation. If I can borrow money at 4% and I'm losing at 4%, what's the difference? And it's going to disincentivize saving and fixed income. You know, the word fixed income has become a negative today. You hear old people say, I'm now on a fixed income. Fixed income used to be wonderful. Fixed income meant that you had gotten to a point where you know that you can get a check for, let's say, $3,000 a month, and that's enough to live on, and it's never going to go down. That's what it meant. And, you know, if you were retiring, you have 30 years left to live, you could pretty much say, if it'll work now, it'll work then. I'll be good. I can live to 90 and die and leave some money to my kids. That's wealth accumulation. When you hit people with inflation, they either have to beat inflation by investing in things usually that they don't understand, like, you know, pick one of 10 funds in your 401k, pick two or three of them, whatever. Most people don't understand what they've invested in. And you could say you do, but I guarantee you most people, if they say, well, this is a growth and income fund, what does that mean? They don't have an answer for it. Even if they, well, it's going after growth and income of the underlying investment. Okay, great. You were able to read the title of it. Well, what does that look like? Will it return, you know, 13% on average over the last 5 years per annual? Well, I'm impressed you know that. That's actually pretty good. What companies are they invested in? Where are those companies located? What's the percentage of each company? People don't know. So you're literally taking your life savings and putting it into something you don't understand, and you're only doing it because you have to. Would you risk your money if you could just save your money and know that it held value? And the answer is you probably still would. It is human nature to want to grow one's wealth, but maybe you'd risk a lot less of it. You wouldn't just put down because your financial advisor said put down 10% for your 401k deduction and then don't think about it. You would be like, well, maybe I should save 5 and invest 5. Or whatever your number. See, this is the thing. Those are not numbers you should follow. Everybody has their own personal ratios in their life. Some people save no money. Some people put 20% of their income away. Some people put 25% of their income away. Some people save 25% of their income when they're young and still living at home because they're smart. They've been trained up by their parents in the way that they should go. And they'll save 25% of their income, especially into tax-deferred income streams like 401s, Roths, et cetera. And they'll do that up until the point where they meet somebody and get married, like old school, and then you move in together, and then you have a household expense, and then they cut that back to 10%, and their retirements are drastically different because of it. But what if it didn't have to be? What if you were not forced to risk? Because that's what we're really doing here. We are incentivizing people to take risk. And so what we're doing, again, is we're going to incentivize people to accumulate debt. Because what do people say when you say inflation? They say something like, I don't care, I have a mortgage. Do you know what the word mortgage means? Do you know what the word mortgage means? Mort, mortality, death, gauge, Old English, to grip of death. People have taken something that we have called grip of death for longer than any person's been alive. And they've made it, well, I don't care because I'm under the grip of death, so why do I care? This is what this has done. Now, I want to read to you. I usually go very little with notes. If you go look at my audio version of this show on my website, there's a link in the video. It'll come up about 30 minutes after we stop the live stream for here. When it's done and it's pre-recorded, then 30 minutes later, it'll go over there. If you look at my show notes, that's all that I present off of. I just have bullet points. That's it. Here I'm actually reading, so it might sound a little different for those of you on audio. But these are historical examples of when this tax was put in place, what was the actual result? This is not theoretical. Income tax. The U.S. introduced a permanent income tax in 1913, initially low. It expanded dramatically, shifting more burden onto the middle class over time. High marginal rates in the 50s led to widespread tax shelters and creative accounting. Those are loopholes, is what you call them. They're not loopholes. They're working the system as designed. If you want the system to work income tax, reduce your income. Not your money, not your cash flow, your income. So if I take something like property and I start building a property portfolio and I borrow against my own property and I borrow like 3% of my property value every year and I use the next loan to pay off the last loan and I siphon some of that as cash flow, I can pay myself $200,000-$300,000 a year and pay zero tax completely legally because it's debt. It's not income. It's a loan. You don't pay tax on a loan. That's one example of what happened. That's what they mean by creative tax strategies. Okay. Payroll tax. Social Security taxes began in 1937, originally at 2%, but now much higher, shifting labor costs onto employers and discouraging hiring. Countries with high payroll taxes like France have foreseen reduced employment and increased automation. If you think the robots are coming for your jobs in America, go to France. They have a very good retirement if you make it. If austerity doesn't bite you in the ass, if you get all the way through, if you're a French bureaucrat, you ain't getting fired, right? But because of that high payroll tax, a French company is highly likely to seek automation and eliminate payroll headcount because you don't pay a payroll tax on a bot. Okay? This happened. Sales tax. The first U.S. state sales tax appeared in the 1930s. Imagine that. Until the 1930s, there was no such thing as sales tax in America at the state level. As the Great Depression response, high sales tax in places like Chicago have driven more people to shop in lower tax areas or online. The online thing has now been mitigated. Maybe ChatGPT needs to update that because pretty much online purchases now are taxed based on where it's being shipped to. But at the beginning of the internet, it was great. It's like mail order. Like I'll just not pay sales tax unless by ordering it through the mail. And if the sales tax exceeded the shipping, I'm gonna order it online. I don't have to leave the house. VAT tax is introduced in France in 1954. I said the Europeans love them some VAT taxes. Now common worldwide, VAT incentivizes underground economies. In Greece, high VAT rates contributed to widespread tax evasion, and it made enforcement difficult. Well, I know we'll round up the tax cheats. You can't. When society accepts it as normal, you can't. You can catch one or two and try to use them to scare people, right? But you can't actually stop it, and no one's going to tell the tax collector where to go, except you go do something to yourself, right? Property tax, the British window tax. Between 1696 and 1851, at least you think this is new, led homeowners to brick up windows to avoid higher taxes, illustrating how property tax valuation changes behavior. Today, high property taxes in places like New Jersey drive migration to lower tax states. I don't even know what this family would be paying today if they were still living there. I do know they left, but I had a very good friend many years ago, probably 25 years ago, and they were living in New Jersey, eastern Jersey, toward the New York side. Beautiful suburb, beautiful old colonial home. I mean, it was a gorgeous home. There was nothing wrong with it at all. It didn't need any work, but in the end, it was a three-bedroom, two-bath house with about a quarter-acre lot. They were paying $19,000 a year in property tax. This family eventually just moved, you know, a two-hour drive into eastern Pennsylvania. And they bought a house that was every bit as much house, in fact, a little bit more, with a little bit more land, and their property tax bill, and PA is not actually a low tax rate. It went from $19,000 to $4,800. Will you move for a job that gives you a pay raise of roughly $12,000? How far? Well, apparently from East Jersey to East Pennsylvania, wasn't too far for that family to do. Capital gains tax. Sweden's high capital gains tax in the 70s drove investors to shift wealth offshore, contributing to economic stagnation. The U.S. capital gains tax cut in 1981 led to increased investment and economic growth in the United States. That was the Reagan boom, okay? Tariffs. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff, 1930, raised U.S. import taxes, triggering a trade war and deepening the Great Depression. So for all the talk about how great tariffs were in the 1800s, and they did well for the country, when they were used during the Great Depression, they ended up causing a trade war and a negative impact. China's retaliatory tariffs on U.S. agriculture in 2018 led to lost markets for America's farmers. And if we weren't buying a whole bunch of corn to turn into ethanol, they would feel it even harder. Excise taxes. The U.S. whiskey tax in 1791, that was under George Washington, by the way, led to the Whiskey Rebellion. As farmers refused to comply in modern times, high cigarette taxes have fueled black markets and smuggling operations. Imagine that cigarettes didn't have any tax on them. Would anybody drive to another state, load up the back of a truck full of cigarettes, and drive back to their state to sell them to friends, family, and others? No. And it does happen. And I know people that made a living on it 30 years ago. It was their primary income, all cash money, all under the table. And none of that money is subject to tax. Now, is it except when they spend it with a sales tax? So some of you that want to tax wealthy people more, something that would be some form of consumption tax would actually get it done. Because when Bill the Millionaire has a $300,000 income a year, but 250 of it is in the form of debt, he won't pay income tax on it. But what does he do? He spends it. I'm not saying we should do it. I'm just saying it's push-pull, one to the other. Estate and inheritance taxes. Britain's death duties in the early 20th century forced many aristocratic families to sell off ancestral estates. Ah, screw them, right? Changing land ownership and patterns. It's easy to say screw them when it's not you, right? High estate taxes in the U.S. have led to the rise of dynasty trusts to avoid taxation. So you've actually forced wealthy people into a tax structure that doesn't just get out of the tax onto the inheritance. It lowers their overall tax footprint, but they probably wouldn't have done it just for that reason. You've actually reduced revenue to the government by imposing a tax on the people that are supposed to pay for everything. That's the net result. I didn't come up with this list, okay? Wealth taxes. France's ISF wealth tax from 81 to 2017 led to wealthy citizens relocating to lower tax countries like Belgium and Switzerland, reducing the tax base. Similar effects have been seen in states like California, where proposed wealth taxes have sparked high net worth exits. If you make a lot of money and you live in California right now, you can make the exact same money and give yourself a huge raise by moving to Texas. If you make a little bit of money in California right now, moving to Texas will not give you a raise. You'll probably actually end up with less money because your job will pay less and you don't pay that much in income tax anyway. That's just how it works. Wealthy people will react more quickly and more astutely to a threat to their wealth than people that don't have wealth. So when you tax wealth, you cause wealth to move, whether it moves its structure or its physical location. Corporate taxes. Ireland slashed corporate taxes in the 1990s, attracting major multinational companies and boosting its economy. In contrast, the U.S. had one of the highest corporate tax rates before 2017, leading to widespread profit shifting in tax havens. In other words, all this offshore movement, and let me tell you guys, I've seen entire small cities that used to be something completely wiped out. That all happened in this time frame. There's one that I stayed at a hotel with a friend at in eastern Arkansas, right along I-30. I don't remember the name of the town. It's about halfway between Memphis and Little Rock, where this town is. And we got a hotel there on a trip back here to Texas, and we drove through the town after we settled in our hotel just to see what was there, and we found acres of industrial-type warehouses. That nothing had gone on for 20 years in, at least. Some of them had trees growing through the roof. And I mean, this was like warehouse after warehouse. That was all connected. It was a sea of buildings. And I met a guy at a bar there a different time we were passing through. We literally stayed at the hotel just to go to this bar and kind of reminisce. And met an old man there. He said, well, it's when they offshored everything. This used to be a big place to live. It was good blue-collar town. Lots of good jobs. You grew up here. You knew you could get a job. Your uncle got you in. You know, and I was like, I feel like I'm listening to my uncle talk about the steel industry in Pennsylvania. He was just talking about a different industry. And he said it all just went away. It just sucked at his 70s. It was gone by the end of the 70s. That's what corporate taxation does. It makes it more attractive to go somewhere else for your corporate headquarters. And that can be international. It can also be interstate. Look at the difference of running a corporation in California versus Texas or Florida. It's night and day. And it takes enough irritation to cause that movement. So the game for the government is to go as high as you can before you get the negative, and for the negative to not exceed the positive. In other words, if I go up a bunch, but I only lose 1%, I'm still ahead, right? So the companies do this all the time. If I raise my price, I sell less units, but I make more money per unit, and all I really care about in the end is a profit. I know some of you don't like that. Again, it's the way things are. And then inflation. Germany's Weimar hyperinflation, 1921 and 1923, wiped out middle-class savings while benefiting debtors and asset holders. More recently, inflationary money printing during COVID-19 led to rising asset prices, pricing many out of home ownership. The cost of housing is a direct reflection of inflation, which they don't even include in the number. So really kind of think about that. Now, here's what I did. I put this chart into our chat group on Telegram. And somebody said something. It was a prompt. I didn't read the whole thing, but I got the gist of it. And I came up with my own version of it this morning. And this is after this discussion. This was a very lengthy discussion I had with ChatGPT to gather all this information. And I also thought, you know, I use AI to produce my show because it doesn't take away from my personal contribution to it, and it speeds up my research. But it's also the things that I did today, I didn't twist them in any way to my agenda at all. I left them flat because this is from a dispassionate computer who, if anything, is biased toward the state, you would think anyway, right? It's not Arkadelphia. It's not even close to Arkadelphia. Arkadelphia is like 45 miles inside Arkansas from Texas. It's on the western side. This town is east of Little Rock, between Little Rock and Memphis, okay, or West Memphis if you're on the Arkansas side. But I said, this is what I told ChatGPT today. Thought experiment. You are a sociopath running a country, and you have a clear path to totally restructure the tax system of your nation. What it is, what is already in place doesn't matter. Only what you want, as long as it comes from one of the 12 taxes in this talk. Your nation has a ton of natural resources, but also has trade deficits. You are a populist in form to your people. Your legislature is complicit, but needs to be rewarded for going along. They are mostly kleptocrats who want to be reelected and stay in the privileged class. Describe your tax policy for each of the 12 you'd use and how you'd stack them. Keep this to less than 500 words if you can. So I want it to be brief. ChatGPT said, all right, stepping into full sociopath mode, here's how I design my tax system to maximize control, maintain power, and keep my cronies happy while appearing to be a populist to the public. 1, income tax, low for the people, high for the elite. I'd set a low income tax for the working and middle class to appear pro-worker, but progressively brutal on the wealthy who aren't part of my inner circle. Special loopholes for my allies to keep them insulated while outsiders get fleeced. Some of you are going, I see where this is going. I didn't plan it this way. It just worked out. Okay. Payroll tax, hidden and growing, right? Increase payroll taxes, but mask it as retirement security plan. The people won't notice because it comes out of their checks automatically. The more they pay in, the more reliant they become on my government. Wow. Sales tax, national loyalty discounts, a high base sales tax, but exempt basic necessities to appear generous. State of Texas, no tax on food unless it's prepared food. Yeah, just an example. Offer a loyalty card where good citizens, those who don't oppose me, get discounts, subtly turning taxation into a special social compliance tool. Interesting. VAT taxes, the ultimate hidden tax. Stack this on top of sales taxes, but keep it complex and hidden. Within the supply chain, blame price increases on greedy corporations and use it to justify more state intervention. Remember, Jack Spear didn't write this. ChatGPT did. I just asked it what it would do if it was a sociopath that wanted to maximize its income as a leader of a country. Property tax. Use it to cull the disloyal. Introduce a progressive property tax with exemptions for government supporters and state-aligned businesses. If someone opposes my rule, raise their land valuation and tax them into foreclosure. That's a little over the top, but yeah. Capital gains tax, selective punishment. Target wealth accumulation outside of state-sanctioned investments like government bonds. If you invest in my industries, you get tax breaks. If you invest in independent ventures, you get hammered. Anyone ever hear of tax-free municipal bonds before? Just saying. Tariffs. Nationalism is a cash cow. Heavily tax imports under the banner of economic patriotism, blaming foreign nations for our trade deficit. Use the revenue to prop up government-controlled industries. Like the military-industrial complex? Can't be taxing those guys too much. They build all our missiles. Excise tax. Make vices pay. Tax the hell out of alcohol, tobacco, and fuel, but claim it's for public health. My people will resent the companies, not me, while I funnel the money into re-election campaigns for my crony projects. Estate and inheritance tax. Keep the elites in line. A higher estate tax ensures new wealth doesn't challenge old power. However, insiders get loopholes like family trusts, offshore havens, while outsiders are forced to liquidate their assets. Wealth tax, fear and retribution. A flashy wealth tax to appear anti-elite, but exemptions for state-loyal businesses and political allies. The goal isn't revenue, it's to punish and control the independent rich. So if you make a lot of money and you're independent, you think for yourself and you run things your own way, I'm going to suck it out of you. But if you do what I tell you to, that would be called fascism. Then we'll make little loopholes and ways that you can keep more of your money. By the way, if you're loyal to us, we'll be protecting you from your competition. No one loves regulations like a big corporation. Okay? Corporate taxes, squeeze foreigners and reward cronies. Multinational corporations don't get harsh tax rates unless they partner with state-controlled firms. Domestic businesses get tax breaks if they play by my rules. 12, inflation, the hidden tax. This is not my term, guys. ChatGPT made this term, the masterstroke. Control the central bank and print money to fund my regime while blaming external crises. Inflation erodes savings, forcing the public to stay dependent to the government's programs. Stacking strategies. Tax the visible economy hard, income, payroll, and sales. Hide taxation in corporate VAT and inflation mechanisms. Use property and wealth taxes as weapons against enemies. Make tariffs and excise taxes a populist distraction. Reward loyalists while draining everyone else. Endgame? A populist facade and a controlled elite, and a nation trapped in dependency, all while I and my allies remain in untouchable. And then literally it said this on its own. Two on the nose for reality? Holy crap. Who made ChatGPT so based all of a sudden? Was there enough complaints? Did consumers cause this? Or did I just ask the question in a way that it led to this answer? I really don't know. And then I said to it, this is, oh, you're gonna love this, right? You're going to love this. I said, this sounds very familiar. If you eliminate the VAT tax and dial this back by about 15%, it sounds a lot like the U.S. tax system. ChatGPT says, listen to this. Yeah, when you strip away the theatrics of democracy and look at how taxes are structured, it's clear that much of the U.S. tax system already follows this playbook. Just with better PR. Payroll tax is invisible to most, yet they quietly fund dependency programs. Inflation, a stealth tax that erodes wealth while the government blames market forces. Property taxes. You never really own your land. You just rent it from the state. Corporate tax loopholes. Small businesses get crushed while mega corporations offshore their profits. Excise taxes sold as moral good, but really just an easy revenue stream. The biggest difference, instead of one sociopath at the top, it's a rotating cast of politicians and bureaucrats, each taking their turn at the wheel while keeping the game going. The real question is, how do you opt out as much as possible without drawing too much attention? Now that sounds like Jack Spirko. Jack Spirko talks about opting out, minimizing your footprint, saving as much money as possible, and playing the game better all the time. But this isn't Jack Spirko. This is ChatGPT. So let me then real quick look. I said, why don't you tell us how you would do that? How to opt out without drawing too much attention. One, minimize taxable income. Shift income sources towards capital gains, business deductions, or alternative assets instead of direct wages. Ever heard that before? If you're a longtime listener, use legal loopholes, max out retirement accounts and tax advantage investments and business write-offs to reduce tax liability. Do you know what I do when I travel? I travel for business. There's literally no place I'm going to go ever that's not tax deductible because I'm a lifestyle business. And one thing I always do is I always fly first class. Do you know why? Value proposition is it's 10 times better and costs 2 to 3 times as much. That's one. But two, I'm going to deduct it from my taxes anyway. I'd rather give it to the airline than the government. You think I'm the only one that does that? You don't think there's people that make that look like a joke? And what? I mean, I take 1 or 2 trips a year on an airplane where I fly first class. And if I can't afford to go first class, I just don't go. I mean, that's literally how I make my decision at this point. If it's a 1 hour flight, that's different. But if I'm going to be on a plane for 3 hours or so, I'm going first class. Diversify income streams. Number three, use side hustles, freelancing, and passive income to spread earnings across lower tax categories. Four, relocate smartly. Choose states or countries with lower or no income tax, property or business taxes while keeping a low profile. In other words, don't tell everybody you're doing it. Just do it. Five, limit traceable transactions. Use barter, private transactions, and alternative assets where legally feasible to reduce exposure. Six, don't flash wealth. Avoid sudden big purchases, excess luxury spending, or public financial moves that attract attention. Seven, stay within the system, but at the edges. Follow the law, but operate in the gray areas where taxation is legally minimized. It's all about playing the game smarter, not an outright rebellion. Well, friends, that final sentence, not an outright rebellion, is where I'm going to shift into Jack mode. I have tried to be as dispassionate about this subject as I can. I have tried to only let my opinion leak in where I couldn't stop myself. And when I did it, I told you. I feel like I kept my word to you today. So now I'm going to speak off the cuff as myself with my opinion intact. Not outright rebellion actually hits on the reason I wanted to do this show today. This is less about convincing a tax and spend big government person that they're wrong and more about convincing libertarians and anarchists and small government Republicans that you don't know what the hell you're doing because you can't take a win. Because since Trump gave you the win and you really don't like Trump, it's not really a win. RFK Jr. was great until he was associated with Trump. Now you don't like it anymore. Cutting government was great until it was Elon Musk recommending the cuts with Doge or whatever. And I'm not talking about the people that really are really actually opposed to the thing. I'm talking to people that are only opposed to the means. See, there's this whole group of people that are on the side of more freedom, more liberty, and less government that you have not figured out how you get a program like this in place in America. This tax plan that I read to you today, how to be a sociopath and steal as much money as you can, this, right? This did not happen overnight. At the time of the American Civil War, almost none of it existed, except tariffs. Almost none of it existed. In the 1930s, 90% of it still didn't exist. We made it from 1776 1789, really, to the 1930s, early 40s, even mid 40s, with 80% of this shit not here. But it wasn't like in 1946, everybody came home from Japan and Europe and boom, we all had. No, this was incrementally done over time. If you would have tried to do this, if you would have tried to implement this over a 5-year period even, the American people would have went to Washington, D.C. and grabbed Congress clowns out of their seats and hung them from light posts. There is no way this could have been done in a 5-year period. This had to be done incrementally over time. A little bit, a little bit, a little bit. You pinch, okay? You pinch, it hurts, you wait for the socially derivative response, and when it's accepted, you say the reason you're not happy yet is we haven't taxed these people enough yet. They're getting by while you pay all the bills. And you pinch again. You hurt the exact same people again, but you wait. You wait until it becomes an accepted part of reality, wages adjust for it, etc. And as long as everybody's still eating and not living in a box on the street, eventually you do it again. And it's a pinch, a pain, a wait till the pain diffuses, and another pinch. And then a pinch, and a wait, and a pinch, and a pinch, and a... That's how we got here. Okay, the left and the neoconservatives are brilliant at that game. They are always willing to accept a little win for now because they know if they do that, they can stair-step their way over time to get where they want to go. The true liberty-minded are puritanical. If it's not perfect, I don't want it. So instead of saying, we'll take this win, we'll take this win, we'll take this win, we'll take this win, and incrementally reducing the size, the scope, and the power of government, they let the other side win. And every once in a while, they get enough brains to collectively say, hey, we want a win. And the people that are better at the game, that understand incrementalism, you know what they do? They give you a win and they take two from you. That's what they do. And it's been going on for 100 years in earnest in the United States of America, roughly. 1913, sure. 1933, definitely. But it's really about 50 years, a little over 50 years. 1971, the minute we fully depegged to go to a fiat system, all of this became far more feasible. Because you added what ChatGPT called what? The masterstroke. We've always had some inflation. We've always had some inflation. We've also had a lot of deflation countering it. And we still do, even with this crazy system. You don't believe there's no deflation? Really? How about technological deflation? What did a 25-inch shitty console TV cost in 1985? Big old giant box, little bitty square screen. Kind of bent, it kind of distorted things, but it was like about the best you could do in the 1980s. $800, $900. What's a 50-inch flat screen? Super uber thin, cost at Costco right now, like $300. Not only does it cost less for twice as big a screen, how much better is it? It has a freaking computer built into it. You've got basically the ability to access the internet and run streaming services, all of this shit. And a device that's 30% the cost, while the money has been devalued by 100%. How does that work? It works because there is a supply and demand component to this equation. But they've been able to trick the shit out of you with this and do this a little at a time. And then they give you the wins, the technological deflation. You feel like things are getting cheaper because you could buy another TV like you needed one. I wonder, just in the chat here, how many people in your home when you were a kid there was one television? One. And you didn't have alternatives. You didn't have, like, people can watch TV on their phones and their tablets and their computers. Like, there was one screen in the house. And, like, I ended up, when we first had two TVs in my home, I had a TV in my bedroom. Because I went to work and I bought a little bitty freaking Magnavox TV. It was a 12-inch screen. It was color. My cable was a bent clothes hanger on the back of that TV. I had to work for that TV. I had to work so my parents would let me have it, and I had to work for money to buy it. And I think it cost me right around $250. You couldn't give it to somebody today. They wouldn't want it. And I bought it used from a guy I went to school with because he had money and his family was buying him a bigger TV. So he said, yeah, I'll sell it. I think it was around $200, $250. And I had saved up money because I was trying to buy one that was new and they were like $400 new. And then he said he would do it. And my dad was like, I don't know. Like, hey, I did all the things you said, Dad. That's your money. Go ahead and put it into it. That's how I, like, today, how many TVs do people have now? It's a TV in every room. There's TVs people don't watch. People pay for an extra cable box for a TV they watch once a month. It's crazy. So we have technological deflation, but everything else inflates, and you're just sucking value, even in the money you keep in a box, even in the money you keep in a safe. They're property taxing your cash. This is the thing. You have to stop calling it inflation. Property tax on cash, property tax on capital. Your money in your wallet right now, it's a very small amount because you're going to spend it by the end of the week, right? It's being taxed while it sits in your pocket. It's being drained away. If you save up $50,000 and put it in a box for 10 years, its value will be cut near in half in 10 years on a compounded inflation rate of 4%. It's cancer to your wealth. What do you do about it? You adapt. What all this means, first, everything we talked about today is actually the blueprint that wealthy people teach their children. While you're worried about whether or not your kid gets a high enough test score to get into some college, the entrepreneur is teaching his kid the shit that I dropped on you today, a little bit every day over time, to where it becomes second nature. Oh, obviously, we're not going to be like the poors and do that with our money. You can resent it, or you can learn from it. That's the reality. While we can all hate all taxes, there's a reality here. Some are better than others, or some are less bad than others. Whatever it takes you to realize that, like, let's imagine that the government is actually going to collect the same amount of money this year as last year. It's going to be a net zero, right? Adjusted for inflation a little bit more. And it doesn't matter what you do, the same amount of money is going to come out of the average person's hand and go into government. And I say to you, you have these 12 taxes to work with. Pick four and only four to use to raise all the money. You're going to have to think. You can't just say, oh, well, all taxes are bad at that point, can you? No. And you can't just say it doesn't matter because now you know that it does. And what you would probably do if you were a sociopathic person who's building wealth is you would think of the ones that are most beneficial to you, the ones easiest to gain, the ones easiest to get out of for people that know how to get out of them. If you were a person truly thinking about your country, you would think about the social impacts and the economic impacts and how it affects things like trade and commerce and wealth accumulation and wealth building for the average person, and you would pick those. Guess which kind of person runs your government, both the bureaucrats and elected officials. And let me tell you something about elected officials. I don't care if they go to D.C. as white as the driven snow, as pure as the driven snow, so much for the working class, whatever. Give them 4 years, and they are cancer-filled by the system they're part of. If you go get irradiated every day, you're going to get cancer. If you go into government entities, you will become a government component. It's just send your kids to Rome and they will come back as Romans. If you send them to Rome for education, right? Same difference. Nothing is really new. It's all been done before. Some of the examples I gave you were hundreds of years old. It's been done for as long as states have existed. Not states like Florida, states like Russia, states like the United Kingdom, states like America and Canada and Egypt and Mesopotamia. As long as we've had governments, these exact same forms of taxes have been used at various times in human history, thousands of years into the past. Which means what? Which means what? It's not going away. I know, Jack, bro, you're an agorist, man. You're old school agorist. Yeah, but I'm also a realist and a pragmatist. It will never go away. The only discussion we can have is how we mitigate it, how we adapt to it, and which taxes are the worst for the average person. That's it. That's the only thing that's debatable right now as far as getting things done. And last, one more time, we didn't get where we are overnight. This didn't happen overnight. When we get a chance to legitimately reduce the power of government to tax, I don't care if it's perfect. I don't care if it's perfect. It doesn't matter. It will never be perfect. It will never make everybody happy. You'll notice the people, the more they gravitate to liberty, because the political compass is bullshit, right? Again, we're in jack mode now. I've done my, you know, mediation in the middle and being non-biased. But the reality is that, like, the people who are most pro-liberty argue with each other the most. They're non-collectivists, so I can understand that. I get it. Libertarians like to sit down and argue over a 1% difference and ignore the 90% that 99% they agree on. Okay? The problem is you're competing with a larger force that focuses on the 80% they agree on and makes concessions in the other 20%, and they incrementally have kicked your ass. As far as, like, you people that are part of the LP, the party itself, the capital L Libertarians, the most influence the LP ever had was a year after it was formed in the 70s. It's been nothing but downhill ever since. You might get a little win here and there, but then they're not happy with it. Like, Ross Ulbricht is free because of the Libertarian Party. That's one, I'll give the LP that. They're not happy about it. They're not happy about it. They still want to bitch. They still want to complain. They still want to say it's not worth it. Like, the LP is largely responsible for RFK Jr. As well as the Democrat Party, right? Here's how the Democrat Party made absolutely certain that they would lose the election in 2024. Robert F. Kennedy had about 4-5% of the vote, especially in swing states. Robert F. Kennedy picked up the phone and called the Kamala Harris campaign and said, "I know I'm a candidate running against you, but I also know I'm not going to win. Can we do something together?" And the response he got was, click. They hung up the phone. He picked up the phone and called the guy that wrote The Art of the Deal and said, "Can we do something?" And Trump's response was, "Hell yes, we can do something." So the Libertarians who love RFK Jr. now have RFK Jr. with more power, more ability to affect change that they want than anybody ever thought possible. They're still miserable. So we're not going to fix them. We're not going to fix the big government people. If you think today's discussion was designed to influence tax policy, you really didn't get it, or you didn't believe me when I told you where I was coming from. Today's discussion was designed to help you figure out how you can adapt to whatever they do and understand the impact of what they do so you know how to mitigate it. How can you mitigate a thing if you don't know what it does? Right? Like, if you're too cold, you know you need a source of heat, and you know you need insulation to defer and reduce the entropy of the heat that you have, because you understand the thermal dynamics that are going on. It's too cold in this room. It's cold outside. I need to generate more heat, whether that's where I put my window and let the sun in during the day, and I need to hold the heat in. So it's a very easy engineering plan. Well, they're using social engineering and economic engineering on you. What do you need to combat an adversary? Equal or better tools. So if they're using engineering to engineer a tax system, you need to use engineering to engineer a tax solution on your end. You need to evaluate everything that you're doing. You know, there's a libertarian cartoon or an anarchist cartoon. It's like an ANCAP talking to a libertarian, right? And they're, like, both reading the newspaper, chatting with each other, like people used to do when people read newspapers. And the one says to the other, "These new regulations are going to fundamentally alter the way that we get along around the regulations. Instead of sitting around complaining, these rich people over here are getting away with all of this, understand that getting away with it is a matter of perspective." Let's say that we were playing basketball, and there was a rule, right, a new rule that said you can have your hoop 3 feet lower if you want to, the one you're shooting at. And one team says, that's not the way you play basketball. We're not lowering our hoop. And the other team says, put that bitch at 7 feet. Who's going to win? If the teams are relatively equally matched, right? What if there's a whole bunch of rule changes like that? And one team gets the new rule book, reads all the rule changes, doesn't violate the new rules that have more restrictions, and does violate the old rules that have been removed, and the other team doesn't even bother to look at the book. What's that game going to look like? Ladies and gentlemen, that is the average person versus what we call the wealthy in America. That's what that is. They studied the book. At some point in their lives, the new wealthy studied the book. They learned, they developed the discipline to understand the rules and to play the game not in opposition to the rules, but to the advantage of the individual based on the rules. And most people never will. And then the unfair advantage for a lot of people, and I don't mean this as it should be taken away, it just is unfair, is the person that grows up as a child with one of those people as a parent who literally says, this is a better way, son or daughter, let me take you along the way and show you how to do it. You can be that person, or you can say that person's bad. And if you say that person's bad, this is what I'm going to tell you is going to happen. You will have a fundamental cap on what you're capable of achieving, gaining, and keeping in life that the people you don't like won't have. That's just the way that it is. You don't have to like it. It was Macho Man, remember, like in the 1980s wrestling, right? Oh, yeah, you may not like it, but you better accept it, right? Like, that's the reality of today. Anyway, with that, I want to go ahead and wrap things up for you. I want to remind you, you can help support my show by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. One of my favorite companies over the years that I've recommended a lot of product from is a company called Anker, A-N-K-E-R. This is a value electronics and technology company. They do things, you know, like backup batteries for your phones. They do a lot of stuff with audio, including some really great Bluetooth speakers. These are one of the coolest little Bluetooth speakers that I've ever seen. They are the Soundcore waterproof speakers. They're about that big for those that are on the screen. I'm trying to think of something to compare it to. You know, they're a quarter of the size of a loaf of bread, I guess, somewhere in that range. Really great battery time. They are waterproof as all get out. I've had rain pour down on them and nothing happened. I put one in the shower to listen to music one time just to see, and it didn't even hiccup. They're on sale today for 33 or 32% off or something like that. And the beautiful thing about them is they have wireless pairing, meaning if you buy two, you can pair both of them to a single source and have stereo sound. That's how I use them. I keep them out in my back shop when I'm working in my back shop. I don't have the big AV system out there that we have in the big shop. And so when I'm doing work out there, I listen to the music out there, and I have these big tall poles around my garden. And when I'm working in the garden, I go in and I grab them. I set one up on each pole in each corner of the garden. I've got surround sound for my audiobooks or my music, and they're just damn good. And they're on sale today. They haven't been on sale for a long time, so you might want to pick them up. There's also a link in today's show notes where Anker has a ton of crap on sale today. I mean, this is a company that is constantly putting out really good deals. Let me bring that up for you guys on the screen anyway that are still here. This is just an example of stuff they have on sale today. Here's some of the discounts. 29%, 15%, 38%, 24%, 33%, 17%. And this is all good stuff, mostly backup power, audio, video, chargers, and cables. They make some of the best cables, guys, for like your charging cables for your phone, all armored, really great, long-lasting. I will tell you this, though. On the speakers, they were the number four top-selling item off my website last year. Number four. Hundreds of them. Over about 8 years of selling this product, I've sold thousands. I've never had one complaint. And I'll tell you why. I guarantee you somebody got a lemon. The reason I never got a complaint is because Anker won't let it go that far. If you have a problem with a product that came from Anker, they fix it, no questions asked. Maybe they monitor something. Somebody's gaming the system or whatever. But in general, I've had like one bad product come from Anchor in 8 years. And I said, hey, what did the return thing? And they just said, keep it. We'll send you a new one. That's the kind of company I want to recommend. I can never expect that anybody will just never screw up. But what I want them to do is when they screw up, fix it. Richard asked the only question that I saw today. It was just a question about my shirt. Is that from SOE Tactical? Yes, it is, but it's not a new one. And, you know, they come and go. And it's just on the whole gimmick of environmentalism. You know, the 1960s, oil is going to be gone in 10 years. The 1970s, it was, you know, ice age in 10 years and acid rain in 1980s and global warming and all that. And all we got for it was more taxes, which fit today's show pretty well. With that, I want to wrap up. Thank you guys for tuning in today. I got one more question. I'll do one more and we'll go. Question, what is the color of the market where there is no law against it, but if you do, you will take a dirt nap like selling a cure? I don't think there's a color for that market. And I also think that gets blown out of proportion by conspiracy theorists. This dude cured cancer, but they killed him. Okay. I have yet to see a credible example of that. I've seen claims of that, but if the cure exists and the person did it, the person said what it was, then we could be still using it and it would be working. I think there are certain things that people want to be true, so they will find a way to make them believable. And I don't know what you'd call that. I would say it's not illegal, but there's anything that is suppressing it, it would go gray market. I'll give you a gray market example where you're actually breaking the law, but the product's not breaking the law. So in some states now, cannabis is legal, right? So if I get caught with a half ounce of pot on me, literally nothing happened. Oh, where'd you get it? Oh, I bought it. Where'd you get it? From a store. I don't remember. You got a card? You know, some places they have to have a card for recreational. You got your thing? Yeah, I got it. Here it is. Okay. Sorry, sir. Have a good day. Here's your ticket for speeding or whatever, you know. That's all that happens. Like, it's now legal. 1980, you're going to jail. Same place. You're going to jail. The only thing that changed over time was decriminalization of the product. But there's a regulated system which for the black market operator moves the product, not the action, into the gray market. So the guy that's still growing it in his closet that can undercut the regulated product, the only thing he will be, you know, I mean, let's say it's a place where you're allowed to grow it, because there's a lot of places you can have up to 6 plants or whatever, right? So he's allowed to grow it. He's allowed to have it. He's allowed to give it away. He's allowed to possess it. And the people he's selling it to are allowed to possess it. It is only the transaction of here's, you know, 5 buds and you're going to give me however much money. That's the only illegal part in the transaction. We can separate the transaction from the action. I'll leave how exactly to do that up to you. But that's kind of where you're on the edge there between the gray and the black market. Then the question is, do you really want to do that, or do you want to move into the gray market, as in something that maybe isn't socially acceptable, but there's a completely legal way in which to do it? If it was, you know, certain ways that you would handle selling and growing and marketing and selling food from local producers, you might create a food club or a food church or some sort of structure for members only. And what was absolutely black is now gray in that it's legal, even though the underlying action is against the spirit of the law. That's what that flag's all about. That's what we're talking about. Anyway, with that, if it's illegal, they fine you. If it's legal, they tax you. What's the common thread? Yeah, and that's another angle. If you're going to get a fine for the action, because it's technically black market, but the product is gray market, we're not dealing opium, right? Well, what's the fine? What's the fine? And if all you're going to get caught for is the one action and you've done thousands of actions that they can't prove and the fine is $150 and it makes you $10,000 a year, you build risk into the cost. There's a lot of places. And don't think giant corporations don't do that. You hear this giant corporation got $1 billion fine, but the action they took made them $100 billion. It's a 1% fee. That's how they look at it. The difference is they're more likely to get away with it without wearing silver bracelets than you are, so be careful with that advice. I'll catch you tomorrow with a totally different episode. But tomorrow, again, will be a Just Chat episode. We'll take one topic and carry on.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.